What does it mean to be Muslim in America? We'll talk with the president of the Islamic Society of North America, who says American Muslims in particular have an enormous responsibility to live as exemplary Muslims and to demythologize Islam to the American public. Hello and welcome to Penn State Public Broadcasting's Common Ground Lobby Talk, which is produced in collaboration with Penn State's Institute for the Arts and Humanities. I'm Patty Satalia. This is an open forum, and we invite dialogue between our special guest and our live audience. Let's begin with an introduction. Dr. Ingrid Mattson is the first woman president of the Islamic Society of North America, the post she was elected to in August of 2006. Raised Catholic in Canada, she converted to Islam at the end of her undergraduate studies, then traveled to Pakistan, where she worked with Afghan refugees. In 1999, she earned her PhD in Islamic Studies from the University of Chicago and is now director of the Islamic Chaplaincy Program and professor at the McDonald Center for Islamic Studies and Christian-Muslim Relations at the Hartford Seminary in Connecticut. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You converted from the Roman Catholic religion to Islam in your senior year in college. Converts are typically very passionate, and it's something that is very, very perplexing to many of us. Why did you convert? How did you become Muslim?
Well, I think it's important to say that when I became a Muslim, when I encountered Islam, at that point I was an atheist or agnostic or maybe just simply indifferent, not someone who was interested in religion or even had God in my life in any way. I had left the Catholic Church, left faith behind as a teenager, and never really looked back. So for me, when I encountered Islam and embraced it, it was the way for me to bring God back into my life. And I did so because of the power of the Quran and reading that and what it said to me about my place in this creation.
But you did describe yourself as a pious child, and it was a trip to Paris and then to Afghanistan to work with Afghan refugees where something happened. What was it that enhanced your vision of Islam?
Well, I first met Muslims, as far as I know, when I studied in Paris one summer where I grew up in Canada. I don't think I knew any Muslims or even heard anything about Islam. So I was very fortunate that the first Muslims I met were students from West Africa, mostly from Senegal, who were just remarkable human beings, very dignified in the midst of great prejudice that they suffered in Parisian society. I mean, very overt prejudice and racism, but they had a dignity and a generosity of spirit that really impressed me, and that made me want to know more about them and their background. Since then, I've realized that they come from a strong West African tradition of Islamic Sufism, which emphasizes a kind of openness to others and the importance of living spiritually in everyday life. And they certainly did that, and that really opened my heart.
Interestingly enough, there are actually two converts in your family. You're one of seven, and you have an older sister who converted to Judaism. Tell us a little bit about that and what the reaction was in your household to this.
Right. I guess my family really does have a bit of a different experience than most Canadian or American families, although as our society changes and integrates, I think this is becoming more common. My sister is significantly older than I am, and she met a Jewish man and fell in love and wanted to marry him. And for the sake of the family and their future children, decided that for her to embrace Judaism would be the best thing. I think that may be one of the reasons why my family was a little bit confused when I chose to become a Muslim, because no man was involved. It was my own choice as a spiritual choice. And that surprised them because I wasn't someone who seemed to be looking for a religion, so it kind of hit them out of the blue. And not knowing any Muslims or anything about Islam, they were concerned. They didn't know what this would mean for my life. So it took a little bit of time for them to be able to be comfortable with it, realizing that it was something that that I could live and have a good life with.
Help us understand this. You have a doctorate in Islamic studies, and the two largest religions in the world, of course, are Christianity and Islam, both of which have divided. The Roman Catholic Church broke into various denominations, and Muhammad left no specific instructions about who should take over and lead the Islam, and the result was that that split into two distinct groups, the Sunnis and the Shiites. What's the difference between the two, and does the Islamic Society of North America embrace both groups?
Right. Well, the major difference between Sunnis and Shiites is a theological difference based on the idea of succession to the Prophet Muhammad, and specifically who is authorized to interpret the Quran and the Islamic principles authoritatively. Shiites believe that that authority was passed down to specific individuals in the Prophet's family, whereas Sunnis believe that it's a collective responsibility of the community to struggle with these texts and precepts and come up with their own conclusion. The Islamic Society of North America is open to all Muslims. Demographically, we are a majority Sunni, but we have Shiite members, and there's no criteria for sectarian exclusionary criteria for our organization. In fact, we had a Shiite president when in our first manifestation as a Muslim Students Association.
What's the relationship between the Islamic Society of North America and Middle Eastern Muslims?
The relationship is only one of emotional ties as part of the global Muslim community, but also we have developed primarily out of the experience of immigrant Muslims who came to study in the United States, found themselves wanting to have some sense of community as Muslims in what to them was a foreign land, formed the Muslim Students Association of Canada and the United States, thinking that eventually they would go back to their homes. Some of them did, but many stayed, had families. Their children didn't want to go back to Egypt or Pakistan or wherever they came from. They realized that this was now their home, and then developed the Islamic Society of North America as the next step, as the kind of fully adult organization that would represent all Muslims. And now our membership includes primarily people who were born in this country, whether they're from a Caucasian or African-American community or second-generation Muslims whose parents immigrated, but they themselves were born here.
The organization itself was established back in 1963, and today you can count some 20,000 people among its members. What's the purpose or the mission of the Islamic Society of North America?
Our mission is to be a common platform for the diversity of Muslims in North America, and that includes individuals and organizations and communities. So in fact, our umbrella embraces even more than those 20,000 individual members, thousands more who are represented in the over 300 mosques and Islamic centers that are affiliated with our organization, as well as professional organizations like the Islamic Medical Association that are part of our membership body. Muslims in North America are highly diverse in terms of their outlook, background, every aspect of demography that you could imagine. And what we seek to do is certainly provide guidance on some issues, but more than that, to provide a common platform for discussion, for dialogue, to engage all the different aspects of this community so that we can come to, if not agreement, at least come to know each other and work for some common goals.
You were the vice president of the Islamic Society of North America 5 years prior to being elected in August of 2006 as president. Many people look at this as maybe the starting point of something bigger, that the significance is not only that you're a woman, but also that you're a non-immigrant. What do you believe is the significance of your appointment?
Well, certainly we're at the stage in our development as Muslims in North America where our leadership should reflect who we are as a community. And it's natural that by now this organization should have someone who's a native English speaker, for example. And this is not to in any way belittle the contributions of all those who served ahead of me. They did a wonderful job and built up this organization. But like every other Muslim community in the world, we should be having institutions and leadership that is homegrown and that is really embedded and relevant to the society. So that's what I see as primarily important. Certainly being a female is something that has gotten a lot of attention. And I think what's the most interesting thing is the fact that it was such a non-issue for our members, that it seems that it was a very natural development to them that having served my two terms as vice president, I would now have the opportunity to serve as president. So I think for many of us, that was more surprising than anything, the fact that there wasn't a lot of discussion about it.
There are some, though, and I think it's a minority, who are opposed to a woman leading this organization. And in fact, there are some who use this saying, which is ascribed to the Prophet Muhammad, which translates roughly to, whenever God wants the destruction of a people, he makes a woman their leader. How do you respond to that?
Well, certainly there are those people who believe that Muslim women shouldn't have public roles. And the question is, what is their proof for that? There are many, many sayings that are attributed to the Prophet Muhammad, and Muslim scholars have always looked at those and tried to sort which are authentic and which are fabricated. Many of them were fabricated for political purposes or people who wanted to support their position, and that's what we have to look at. When we see, in fact, and we weigh any particular saying against all the other things the Prophet Muhammad said, what he did, and also the message of the Quran, which is clearly states that Muslim women can contribute to the same level and in the same way as Muslim men. We see that women had public roles during the lifetime of the Prophet Muhammad, and his immediate successors followed women who were in leadership positions. So when we look at the preponderance of evidence, I think we have to give these other reports their place.
Are you saying that particular saying can't justifiably be attributed to him?
Well, this is a question of hadith scholarship, and I would defer that to those who are specialists in that area, but there has been a lot of discussion about that statement and whether it in fact violates many other clear Quranic statements about gender equality, as well as other statements attributed to the Prophet Muhammad.
In your role as the president of the Islamic Society of North America, you say you have detect what you would call Muslim fatigue among North America's Americans. And in fact, you say, the sense I have from Americans is that they don't want to hear Muslims talking about Islam anymore. They just want us to do something to stop causing all these problems in their lives. And I'm wondering, is this the challenge for you as president? And how you're going, what you're going to do to make Islam better understood among Americans?
I think the first challenge is to show that Muslims are like other people, in that we have our good guys and our bad guys. there are criminals in Muslim societies, just as there are criminals in Christian societies. The United States has around 2 million people in jail, probably most of them Christian. So we don't judge people and a civilization and a religious community by the worst of them. And I think that's the real challenge, because Americans are naturally interested in the ways that Islam is impacting their lives. And the reality is that there were people, and there have been people, who have used Islam to justify violence and terrorism. And in particular, the terrorist acts of 9/11. That's a reality. So Americans are going to be first and foremost interested in that. And they want Muslims to do something about it. We would love to do something about it. But what kind of role do we have? We have our voice, we have our writing, we have our example, but we are not ultimately in control of these people who are doing these things. And I think it's that sense of collective guilt or responsibility that we really have to try to avoid and explain to American people and have them see that it's unfair to put that burden on us.
I want to ask you one more question, and then I want to open it up to our audience for their questions. Terrorists killing in the name of Islam, you say, is not the true Islam. Describe the true Islam, the five pillars, if you will, to help explain for those who don't know what exactly the doctrine or the underpinnings are of this religion.
Well, Islam primarily is about belief in God and about the unity of God. And what that means is that Muslims recognize their limitations. That's why we try to submit ourselves and our lives to in obedience to God. And what that means is that we live our lives first in that awareness. We exhibit that through our acts of worship, as you say, the five pillars, praying five times a day in ritual prayer, even more than that, I mean, supplications and invocations, but the ritual prayer five times a day, fasting during the month of Ramadan, the pilgrimage to Mecca, paying yearly a significant amount of our wealth.
In fact, 1% of your salary goes...
2.5% of a Muslim's wealth has to go for annually to the zakat, to the charity. For me, I have to pay 1% of my income to the Islamic Society of North America as a member of the board. So that's an extra commitment. But all of these things are to show our gratitude to God. And that's what Islam really is about. It's about showing gratitude for all of the things that He's given us, even our own selves, our ability to speak and to live in community with each other and try to live in the most merciful and humane way that we can.
Is there a question in the audience?
Yes, I wondered whether you were concerned about the potential for the radical Islam group to become involved in mosques around the United States and sort of dominate the voice of Islam in the United States, and what you and your organization could do in response to this?
That's a great question, thank you. The challenge in American Islam in particular is that we do not have a hierarchical church structure. In fact, we have a very loose kind of voluntary association. And because of that, each community is individual. So there's no, our organization has no authority to go into any mosque and demand that they run a certain way or speak a certain way. But what we can do and what we are doing is developing a set of best practices for mosques and Islamic centers to develop guidelines for those communities, how their governance structure should work, what qualifications there should be for imams, what's the kind of training that an imam should have, and to then once we have developed these guidelines, offer training programs. So we have a number of training programs for imams to help them understand their context, especially if they've come from another country, because the reality is that many communities are still bringing imams who have been trained in other countries who may be good preachers, they may be good theologians, but they don't understand necessarily the context of their community here. So we're putting a lot of energy into that, trying to help orient them, train them, and then ultimately, and ideally, have our own seminaries in this country where we can have our own children and our own young people be a generation of leaders.
You say that American Muslims have a special obligation to help stop the violence that is committed by Muslims in the name of Islam. Why do American Muslims have this special duty to do that?
Well, as I said before, we don't necessarily have any special power, but we do have an obligation because we have the freedom to talk about these issues. And the reality is that most Muslims in the world live in environments where they don't have that freedom because their political rights are suppressed, their freedom of speech is very limited. They may not have access to the resources that we have. So there's a moral obligation for us to exercise that kind of leadership. And it doesn't mean there's anything special or unique about Americans, but we have this rich, diverse Muslim community. We have Muslims from every part of the world. So we can draw upon their experiences, their heritage, their perspective, and debate these issues in a way, in a free way, so that we can then encourage a discussion in other countries. The other thing is that we're Americans, we're part of this country, and the United States is heavily engaged in Muslim countries, you know, in their economic policies, their political policies. So we also need to look at it as American citizens. How can we be a bridge of understanding between the United States, our policies, and Muslims in other countries?
You said that you previously never spoke, for example, about suicide attacks committed by Muslims in the name of Islam. You said that you didn't avoid the subject, but that it really wasn't something almost on your radar screen. What prompted a change in that? Why is that something that you do talk about now?
I think many Muslims in America, like many Americans before September 11th, we're rather parochial. I mean, this is a big country and we have so many things going on here. We don't necessarily see our connection to what's going on in other countries. And my major concern as an educator and as a Muslim leader was the development of our organizations here in this country, our schools, our mosques, our associations. But when all of us were shocked by the events of September 11th, we realized that if we didn't pay attention to what was going on in the rest of the world, it would still impact us. And so at that point, we had to look closer at the kind of discourse that was happening in other Muslim countries, the way that Islam was being used to justify certain violent actions and take a stand on that, and so we proceeded to do so.
In fact, you say American Muslim leaders who oppose the oppression of Muslims on the one hand and also want to fight terrorism risk being seen as traitors by both sides, and I'm wondering if you personally have felt any backlash as a result of your outspokenness.
Certainly it's a challenge. And Muslims in other parts of the world look to us as Americans as well as Muslims. And so they want us to do something about American policy that they don't like or that they feel that negatively impacts them, whether they understand the intricacies of that policy or not, I think is another issue. But then on the other hand, there is an unfortunate feeling on the part of much of the American public that Muslims need to prove themselves. They're guilty until they prove that they're innocent. And that if we say something that any other American would be free to say, for example, something about the Iraq War, suddenly it's not because it's a moral issue or American issue, but because as Muslims we really don't have the interests of the United States at heart. Even though the majority of Americans in the last election, I think, showed that they were unhappy with much of the way the Iraq War is going, somehow it sounds a little bit different when it comes out of from a Muslim perspective.
I think there is probably another question percolating out here. Go ahead. Well, let me get a microphone to you, and in the meantime, while that microphone gets there, there are 6 million Muslims in America. And I think in the U.S. and in places like Europe, many people want to know, and you talked about how diverse the population is, but are Muslims interested in integrating, in separating, or in some way transforming Western culture to become a little more Islamic? How would you answer that?
Yes, to all of those things. And I think this is the key, that we have to treat Muslims as individuals, not as a collectivity. Muslims represent a broad scale, a broad range of cultural and ideological positions, just as Americans do. I think when we look in the United States and the history of religious communities in the United States, we see those utopian communities that tried to be somehow a presence, a spiritual presence, apart from the world, to offer an alternative to the dominant culture. And then we see those who felt that it was best to live their spirituality and their ideals right in the midst of it, and to try to be part of everyday life, but be a moral voice amidst that. So I think we find the same thing with Muslims. In the United States, I would say that the majority feel that it's best to be active, to be part of everyday society, and most Muslims do that. The Muslim community in the United States is, on average, more educated and more well-off than the average American. So we see that there tends to be more assimilation in the United States. The situation in Europe is a little bit different, and many of the Muslim communities there come from countries that were colonized by the Europeans, and now there's a kind of blowback. You know, the Europeans invaded and occupied their countries, and now these people are coming and are living in Europe, struggling with racism, struggling with European countries that are not quite as open to diversity and pluralism, perhaps, as the United States, and not quite as open to public expressions of religion as the United States. So the dynamic is significantly different, I believe, in Europe than in this country.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, you alluded to the responsibilities of being a Muslim American, but I wonder if you could say, given the sort of stereotype that is sort of pervading, even before 9/11, I mean, I was reminded that in the Oklahoma City bombing, the initial attribution was to Muslims, or at least Arabs. How do you advise members of your group, and particularly young people, I guess I'm interested in knowing, about dealing with that stereotype and still exercising their freedom of speech as Americans?
I'm really glad you brought up young people, because they're the ones that I'm most concerned about, and I'll tell you why. This kind of stereotyping and distrust of Muslims is having a large negative effect on them. I have a lot of interaction with Muslims who are counselors, psychiatrists, working in mental health fields, youth workers, and they've seen a dramatic rise in depression, anxiety, indicators of stress because of this. They feel that they can't present themselves just as they are, but they have to somehow explain or prove themselves that they aren't violent. You know, they're just kids. They don't know. They don't understand what's going on in the world, but they're being asked to explain these things. So it's really problematic, and this is where, as a community, we need to work with teachers and those who touch the lives of young people to alert them to this dynamic and try to find ways to ease their stress somewhat. The only solution really is education. It's challenging for a community, a minority community, that's at most 2% of the population to impact the other 98% of the population in a positive way with their message, when at the same time we're constantly being bombarded with images overseas of war in Iraq, of this kind of violence. So it's an enormous challenge, but I have to say that we're also very fortunate that we are not alone in doing it. There are so many faith-based organizations, interfaith groups, other religious organizations who are sincere in wanting to help us and to help get that message out. And we have, in my work at Hartford Seminary, I interact with priests and ministers who themselves are educating their congregations on Sundays and saying, we cannot fall back into these old patterns of collective guilt and stereotyping. So to me, that is proof of really the best that is in American society, and it makes me hopeful even amidst all of the bad news.
And we'll take another question. In just a moment, we'll get a microphone to you. So until that microphone gets there, there was a recent Gallup poll that showed that nearly 40% of Americans admit prejudice against or towards Muslims, and also that one in five Americans said they would not want a Muslim as a neighbor. How do you respond to that?
Well, what's interesting is the other statistic, that the majority of Americans who have a positive view of Muslims do so because they have a Muslim neighbor or a Muslim friend or a coworker. So I think that shows that the problem really is that of the fear of the unknown, or maybe the fear of the image that's being projected. That really is the challenge. And certainly programs like this and others are doing their part in humanizing Muslims, in trying to present a balance to the negative images that we get. But it's challenging, and I think that what's required is, as in many other areas, for Americans to be a little bit more sophisticated in their consumption of news, and perhaps to be a little bit more self-aware of their own, the way that their own emotions can be manipulated by news and information and images.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago the news and the media and our consumption of those things, and of course many Americans have seen the documentary The Cult of the Suicide Bomber, or at least they've seen the movie that was based on it, which starred George Clooney, Syriana. And in it, in the documentary, there is a scene where thousands of people are in a mosque in Iran chanting "Death to America." Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how your organization can counteract the powerful message that sends.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a powerful message, and it's a frightening message. And it's also frightening when we look and we see that even in America, there are churches where the message on Sunday is that Muslims are evil. Muslims are people who should not be part of this country. That the government should use its power, in fact, to subdue Muslims. Those things happen in this country, and when I see those group pictures, I remember the pictures that we saw of Nazi Germany, where you would have Hitler talking in front of large crowds of people and whipping up their emotions. And I think as Americans, we have to be very sober and consider in what way the same thing could happen to us. We may not be sitting in a stadium, but we're sitting, millions of us together in our homes, having our emotions manipulated. But there also was the time when Afghanistan was first attacked in response to September 11th. The first attack and the announcement of it was announced Sunday football game, large screens, thousands of Americans sitting in a stadium, and they all got up and cheered when this was announced. And that's frightening.
You talked a moment ago about what it's like for a child, a Muslim child in America. What's it like for an adult? Have you been the victim of prejudice?
Of course, I'm very privileged because I work in an environment that values religion and religious expression. Of course, walking down the street, people wouldn't know that, and I've had my random rude comment here and there, but far more positive comments, far more occasions of people just giving me a smile, clearly wanting to say, it's okay, I accept you, even non-verbally. But there is a concern. Many people are having increasing challenges in their workplace. We've heard many more cases of employment discrimination, Muslims who are being fired or prevented from promotion in their job because they are Muslim. Certainly the number of hate crimes generally has increased enormously. The Council on American Islamic Relations has been documenting that, and the numbers are quite frightening. So there are, there is a problem. There is a problem, and it's at that point incumbent upon the government to really take leadership. Fortunately, the Department of Justice and the EEOC have taken a number of cases and have done a good job. But at the same time, you know, we have this kind of mixed message. You have those cases, and then on the other hand, we see the mistreatment of prisoners, of Muslim prisoners. There was recent news about Jose Padilla, who has been virtually tortured as an enemy combatant. And when ordinary people see that this kind of thing is going on, I'm afraid that it might give them some kind of license to feel that they too can mistreat Muslims.
You mentioned government, and of course, Britain's Tony Blair said that the headscarf separates Muslims and shouldn't be used. And I'm wondering what your reaction is to that and what the purpose of it is, what it means to you.
Well, what's interesting is that Tony Blair was supporting Jack Straw, who was protesting against the face veil. So they said, well, the head covering's okay, but the face veil is too much, and this is a sign of separation of society from society and should be rejected. And I don't know if you've been in London, but I've walked around London before, and I've seen some really interesting ways of dressing. I've seen 9-inch purple mohawks. I've seen multiple facial piercings, and I've never heard the British government comment on any of those modes of dress. So clearly there is selective treatment there, and I think it's unfair. These women should be free to wear what they want. It's the government's job as the servant of the people to represent the people, not to dictate to them their way of dressing. Whatever I feel personally about the face veil is something else, but I certainly support the right of individuals to wear what they wish. And so this was simply a politicization of an issue that should never have been said.
Okay. You had a question, sir?
Yes. Do you believe that the American news media have been fair in their presentation of the situation of Muslims in America, or do you think they have contributed to the problems that you're talking about?
Well, the news media is diverse, and I've had great experiences with commercial media, but public television and radio is much better, and that's just the reality. Commercial media is about making money, and it's things that are sensational that make money. Conflict attracts attention. I think of the Pope's visit to Turkey, and what was interesting was you could see that the media was looking for conflict, and they kept framing this visit in terms of conflict, when in fact any fair observer would have said that the real story was the lack of conflict, and was the real story was that in the wake of a number of incidents in Europe where there was tension and stress between Muslim communities and others, that things worked out quite well. So I think, I don't think we can ever really change that, because that's the nature of commercial media. So we need to be sophisticated observers of news, I think, and consumers of news.
And we'll get a microphone to, can we get a microphone to someone here?
Could you talk a little about the Muslim definition of God and how it might differ from the Christian notion?
Well, the word God that is used in the Quran, Allah, the primary word, is the same word that Christian Arabs use to call God. So in terms of whether this is the same God or a different God, I think we have to say that certainly the Quran recognizes that there's one God, and that people have approached God through different ways. Christians, generally, you have to believe in the divinity of Jesus to be a Christian. I think that most Christian theologians would say that not accepting the divinity of Jesus would take you outside of Christianity, although there are certain Christian theologians who would say otherwise. But that really is the main difference. Muslims see Jesus and all the prophets as perfect recipients of the divine light. And as one of my colleagues, Timothy Winter, who's a lecturer at Cambridge, said, is that what the Muslim view was that Christians mistook the perfect mirror of the divine light for the divine light itself. So really, that's where the difference is. God in the Quran is described in many ways with many attributes, and that's how Muslims approach God, through his attribute of mercy and kindness and loving and forgiver and creator. So that's how we come to know God. Sometimes people say that the Muslim God is so transcendent that he's unapproachable, but that's clearly not the case. The Quran describes God as closer than your jugular vein. So God is always the nearest thing to you without being manifest in any part of creation.
But another interesting difference, and we'll take a question in a moment, is Christians have statues and paintings and so forth of Jesus, and there aren't those kinds of representations of the Prophet Muhammad. In fact, it's forbidden, considered blasphemous. Why is that the case?
Islam, above everything, wants to maintain the uniqueness of God as distinct from creation. So the attempts of humans to portray God in any way is considered to be highly presumptuous, at least. And then the fear is that by portraying prophets, the Prophet Muhammad, for example, by making depictions, that people then may start to take that as an icon, as a avenue of worship, and that's to be avoided. So that Muslims try to maintain that connection of God, that connection with God directly through prayer, but also by embodying the actions of the Prophet Muhammad that taught us how we can approach God, what way should we pray to find that path to God.
Okay, we have a question over here, sir.
Your mini bio mentioned that you spent time in Pakistan. My daughter spent 4.5 years in Peshawar working with Afghan refugees. I can't well represent her comments, but in effect, she would say to you that a great deal of so-called Islamic practice is pagan. It has nothing to do with the Quran. Mm-hmm. And in fact, while she was there, mullahs were giving her grief all the time. They would say the Quran says, when they could neither read Arabic nor speak Arabic. And she, in fact, had the Quran translated into Urdu, emphasizing women's rights and emphasizing sanitation and health because of the terrible practices that apparently these men perpetrated, especially in things like childbirth and so on. I'm seeking your comments on that particular point.
Right. Well, there's certainly different levels of education among Muslim people, and the Quran emphasizes the need for learning, for knowledge, and knowledge not just of scripture, but of the natural world. And this is why we see that at the height of Islamic civilization, that Muslims were at the forefront of medical knowledge, for example, discovering the mysteries of the circulatory system and others. So when we see Muslims in certain parts of the world who are resisting modern knowledge, who are in fact resisting even much literacy in religion, it is troubling. At the same time, I would have to say that we can't brush them all off. I met remarkable people of great spiritual depth among the Afghan people and in Pakistan, despite their challenges. But certainly there are many cultural practices that are being portrayed as religious, whether the people know it or not.
Okay, go ahead.
You mentioned diversity before, and I understand that your society likes to promote pluralism so that everyone can have their own identity of Islam. But isn't this also difficult, and how do you deal with the differences of viewpoints and when maybe you see any conflicts come up? And also, for the new generation of non-immigrant Muslims, how is your society helping them to find their way in identifying with Islam?
Well, this is one of the biggest challenges, is to, on the one hand, provide guidance in those areas where we need to take a stand, and on the other hand, keep the door open for respecting other opinions. A famous or maybe infamous issue is the issue of moon sighting, where we have to make a decision on the method by which we will begin, we will decide when the new lunar month begins. That's important to know when the beginning of Ramadan starts for fasting, when we celebrate the Eids. And there are different ways of doing that. People feel very strongly about the different methodologies that are employed. Our society has taken a certain position that we believe is the best position for Muslims in North America, but not the only position. And so it's being able to say, look, there are a variety of equally valid positions, but this is what we believe is the best. That is challenging for some people who just want one answer, who want a simple answer. And certainly in my teaching, what I try to do is to let young people come to terms with that, come to terms with the diversity that is present, and that they have to recognize in Islamic legal reasoning at the same time to be able to make a decision. I mean, you can't just say, okay, there are all sorts of opinions. At some point, you have to take one yourself and then feel a certain confidence in that.
All right, we have a question down here.
I'm interested in Sufism, and I would like to know what is the relationship between Sufism and Islam, and why we haven't heard much about Sufism in the West. Mm-hmm.
Sufism is the mystical tradition in Islam. It's part of Islamic religious life and culture. Sufism in its various forms is everywhere in the Muslim world. Traditionally, in the pre-modern period especially, every Muslim had a legal school that he or she followed, a theological school, and also a spiritual tradition. Through the different Sufi brotherhoods. Now, these spiritual paths took all different forms. Some of them, I think any objective observer would say, really veered away from Islam and became quite syncretic and picked up many of the traditions or practices that non-Muslims performed. But most, the majority of Muslims stayed within Orthodox Islam. But Sufism was an added discipline to enhance their spirituality of Islam. I think many Americans know about some Sufi figures, people like Rumi or Hafiz, who were great poets and also Sufi leaders. But it is something that perhaps is less well known. Again, because good news travels slow and bad news travels fast.
We talked a moment ago about Pope Benedict and his four-day visit to Turkey, mm-hmm. to Istanbul. He prayed in silence for 2 minutes beside an imam, mm-hmm. Facing Mecca and in Istanbul's famous Blue Mosque. His guide in Istanbul said that that gesture was more powerful, more meaningful than an apology. And I'm wondering if you agree and how far you think that went in healing the rift that was caused by his earlier statement.
Well, I think there's two separate issues. I'm not fully satisfied with that that the Pope understood the reason why people were upset with what he said. So I'm not quite sure that he still got the message about that. It wasn't just about hurt feelings, but it was also about the factual basis for what he said.
But I thought he disagreed with that statement anyway, because he followed up his remark, and he said, "Show me just what Muhammad brought that was new, and there you will find things only evil and inhuman, such as his command to spread by the sword the faith he preached." But he went on to say that violence is incompatible with the nature of God and the nature of the soul for all faith. So I thought some people agreed that he was disagreeing with that statement, not confirming it.
Well, I think it's up to him to clarify his intention and his remarks. Having read the whole speech, I do think there was something problematic. But what I would like to focus on is the fact that whatever that was about, the good news was that he did not cancel his trip to Turkey. The Turks greeted him, by and large, hospitably. Graciously, for a country of approximately 80 million people, there were really very small, tiny demonstrations, relatively. And the fact that he was allowed and invited into the Blue Mosque, what Turks would Turkish Muslims would consider to be their most important mosque in Turkey, shows that we understand that we won't always agree with each other, that sometimes we will hurt each other, but that doesn't mean that we have to cut off relations. And the fact that we have, as Muslims and Catholics in particular, over the last maybe 10 years or more, have been working very hard to establish good relationships, ties, alliances, paid off at that moment. That we were able to fall back on those relationships and say, you know, this was unfortunate, it was hurtful, but that doesn't mean that we can't continue to dialogue and try to work for greater understanding.
As a Muslim, very interested to talk about how we deal with difficulties, because when we have public discussions, inevitably because of the context in which such discussions take place, we try to emphasize, and I think this is a good thing, the good news and the positive. But you said something to me which struck me as very important and very honest. And you said that there are sometimes actions among us Muslims which are more undermining and dangerous and offensive, both to ourselves and also to the wider world. And I was wondering how you deal with some of these difficult issues of great differences, whether they're theological or political or strategic. Because I think it heartens me that there is that degree of self-reflection, but also agreeing to look at the difficult subjects and deal with them creatively.
Thank you. Ultimately, our goal as Muslims is to live righteously and ethically. Our goal is not to be some kind of group that just cheers whatever it does. That, in fact, is what Ibn Khaldun, the great medieval Arab scholar, called asabiya, group sentiment. Religion isn't supposed to be group sentiment. It's not supposed to be about just sustaining and justifying your group beyond anything. Yes, we're supposed to build community, but what is that community built around? If it's not built on piety and righteousness and the search for what is good and better, then there's no value in it. And the Quran says very clearly that if Muslims make the same mistakes and choose to turn away from God, and live a life that is unjust, then we will go down the same path. We will lose our opportunity to be moral leaders and we'll be replaced by someone else. So that's the priority. To me, the priority is our own internal structure, our development as a community. We do have to defend ourselves from external attacks, but we have to be proportionate. What is an attack? Clearly, legislation that discriminates against Muslims and impedes Muslims' abilities to live as Muslims is a problem. That is a real threat. And we face some of those threats, and we need to put resources into defending ourselves And unfortunately, when we do that kind of defense, it takes away some of our ability to deal with our own internal problems. After 9/11, so much money in the Muslim community and human resources went into legal defense and to defend the civil rights of Muslims in this country that could have been put into, you know, developing our institutions to be more responsible and responsive to the needs. So that's unfortunate, but it's something that we have to do. And I'm happy to see that there's an eagerness and a hunger among Muslims to take responsibility for their own communities. And I love to see that. I love the fact that there are many Muslims who say, you know what, this is my mosque, this is my community. I'm not gonna just sit back anymore and, you know, listen to some speech that is offensive, that is sexist, that is whatever. But I'm gonna take some responsibility for what's going on here and try to correct that.
We're gonna wrap things up here. So I'd like you to end by giving us a take-home message for Muslims and non-Muslims and what you as the president of the Islamic Society of North America will be putting your energies into when you leave here.
Well, my main message is that as a religious person, as someone who's trying to please God, I have to say that we need to do a better job, all of us. That God did not give us the resources that we have, the enormous resources that we have in America, so that we could fight each other more sophisticatedly. He gave us those resources so that we could improve the world, so that we could care for the hungry, so that we could demonstrate compassion and mercy in our lives. We need to do that in community. That means that Muslims need to reach out to their neighbors. They need to reach out to Christians and Jews and those of goodwill who are trying to improve the situation. And Americans need to stop being afraid. They need to stop giving in to that fear and have a certain confidence. This is a strong country. This is a country that can that has undergone many pressures, economic, political, military in the past, and has always come out on top when it acted ethically and morally and lived up to its values. So stop being afraid and don't give up what makes you an American for the sake of fear. And if you reach out to your Muslim neighbor, you will find, by and large, although there are some of us are rude and obnoxious and not that nice, but I think by and large, you'll find a good experience with most of us.
And your priorities in the coming year?
Priorities are standards, and developing a new generation of Muslim leaders who are going to work in this country to make Islam a responsible, relevant, dynamic faith community.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Ingrid Mattson, for being with us. We really appreciate it, from the Hartford Seminary in Connecticut. For all of us at Penn State Public Broadcasting, I'm Patty Satalia. Thanks so much for joining us.
Very nice of you. You did a wonderful job.
A copy of the program you've just seen can be purchased through Penn State Media Sales at mediasales.psu.edu or by calling 800-770-2111.